You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody who's participating. Thank you for joining us from around the world. I know we have a number of folks in different time zones. I'm thrilled on behalf of the entire team who's worked on this Family School Engagement Playbook to welcome you. And I want to first start off with a huge shout of thanks to our Family Engagement and Education Network members. I would name every single one of them, but there are close to 50 partners on the ground, leading jurisdictions, leading parent organizations, leading nonprofits. So I won't have time to name them, but you know who you are. This was very much a co-creation process to get to this point. We're so grateful for all the time and effort and all the parents and teachers you helped input into this process, their voices. We're also hugely grateful to our supporters. I want to give a many thanks to particularly the LEGO Foundation and the BHP Foundation for being incredible funders, because they were quite flexible when COVID hit and allowed us to pivot and continue this work in unplanned ways. And a big, huge thanks also to our partners who joined us along the way, along the journey. This has been a 3-year project, half before COVID, half after. And huge thanks to the Grable Foundation, who developed the Parents as Allies project to join this effort and brought in Kidsburg and IDEO and 100 as partners developing this. So thanks to everybody. We are going to have a lively conversation today in two sessions, two dialogues. I'm so pleased to introduce very special guests with us. The first dialogue I'm just going to introduce them and not yet invite them to the screen. The first dialogue is going to be with Minister Adutum, the Minister of Education of Ghana, and Sarah Bushi, the Chief Impact Officer of the LEGO Foundation. And I would be remiss here if I didn't say that we appreciate the LEGO Foundation for many, many reasons, but especially their respect of our independence. And just want to reiterate, which is true for Sarah and every other panelist, that the views here are solely of those of the speakers. And then in the second dialogue, we will have Carolina Pinheiros, who's the Executive Director of Fred Papas, and Deputy Secretary Sandoval, who's the Deputy Secretary of Education of the New Mexico Public Education Department in the U.S. We're so pleased to have you. We will be taking questions as we have this lively exchange and debate that will be fast moving. I just tweeted out, you can go to at Rebecca Winthrop, the hashtag, it's hashtag family engagement, and a link to the playbook, because we've already had two questions in from Francis from Zion Basic School and Debbie from Johns Hopkins, who have asked, how can they get their hands on the playbook? How can they get more follow-up information? The other thing we will be doing is, everyone who's participating today, we will send you an email tomorrow with all the links that are online, if you don't find them on Twitter, and also an invitation to sign up for a guided workshop if you are interested in having more in-depth discussion around the contents of the playbook with your teams. Please do sign up for that. And so with that, I would like to invite onto the screen Minister Adutum and Sarah Bushi, and we will get started. Thank you both for being here. Mr. Minister, is your video working?
Yes, sure.
Coming. Perfect. So huge thanks to both of you. There's a couple of topics and themes I want to talk about today with you. The first one is really around the importance of family school engagement. And I want to share with you my motivation for why we did this playbook and why we thought it was so important. And I know both of you, over the long course of your public service and education, have worked heavily on family school engagement at different points in time. Mr. Minister, I'm thinking about earlier on in your career when you were running a charter school network in Los Angeles, in the United States, you heavily leaned on family school engagement as an important strategy. And Sarah, I'm thinking about your work prior to the LEGO Foundation, where you led a global girls' education initiative across many countries. And I know deep engagement with community was really essential for you too there. So I'll first frame why we were motivated to do this and then turn to you to see why you think family engagement is so important, particularly in light of COVID. So from my perspective, you both well know that we have been working very hard and are quite worried about education inequality. And ever since several years ago now, I did this research with my colleagues, Eileen McGivney, on the 100-year gap, which is basically this terrible finding that in many countries, the kids who are most poorly served by the education system, it's going to take about 100 years to catch up to the kids who are well served by the education system, given the current pace of change. And we've been looking at leapfrogging strategies to accelerate progress. And one of those strategies that we've been looking on in our book, Leapfrogging Inequality, was around activating and tapping any sort of asset in the community that could come in and complement and support children's educational experience. And we were heavily looking at an educational experience that is rich, holistic, and fit for a 21st century for all children and develops a breadth of skills. So we really felt that harnessing sort of the power of family and community is one way, it's not the only, to rapidly accelerate progress and address this education inequality gap. And I also think that because of COVID, really putting family engagement on the map for education systems, it's a real moment to transform how we do family school engagement long term, moving in the future. One of the insights we found in our playbook is that parents moving forward are really expecting to be more deeply engaged in their kids' education. We see that in nationally representative surveys across multiple countries. I wanted to read one quote from a parent who we talked to in a focus group who I thought summarized the feeling. This parent says, "I felt like I knew more during the school closures what my child had been learning than the entire 3.5 other years she's been in school." So I wanted to start off with you, Minister Aduotum. You know, why, tell us about your perspective on family school engagement, why you've thought it certainly has been important, and how your perspective has changed because of COVID. So over to you.
Thank you so much. Wonderful opportunity. I hope you know that I've become an ambassador of leapfrogging inequality everywhere I've spoken. If you follow my speeches on YouTube, you are more likely to hear about leapfrogging inequality. It has created a sense of urgency for me, even before I became Deputy Minister for Education and Minister for Education. Now I'm the minister, and I get to be able to push policies and ideas to a very high level and to get the president to really give me the leverage to move things forward. But leapfrogging inequality has actually changed or given me the impetus and the sense of urgency. And I tell people, we won't be around in the next 100 years. And if you want to catch up the next 100 years, do you think that other people are waiting for you to catch up in the next 100 years? By the time you get there, they are gone ahead of you. So in Ghana, our leapfrogging inequality and the underlining strategies are something that we are using in every facet of our education transformation agenda. We believe that parent engagement, as you rightly pointed out, is critical as one of the leapfrogging strategies. The question that I've posed to educators in Ghana, both teachers and members of the elite class and others, is this simple concept. I call it the 90-90-90 plan. What it means is that by fourth grade, that is age 10, I want 90% of the students to be able to read and write proficiently. And I ask them that if I come to your village, a small village, if I get 90% of the students to read by age 10, and I get 90% of those students to move on to high school, and from high school, 90% to move on to tertiary, what will happen to that village? And everyone says there will be total transformation. But this is not difficult to do. So now we've created what we call communities of excellence, where the chief of the village is the patron of education, the queen mother is the ambassador for education, the whole community, we told them, we need to find accommodation so that the teachers will live in the community. And we are going to have a small library. The Library Authority of Ghana is going to supply the books. Put a set of books in this school, then we have a coordinator who then support the literacy program at the school. And what it means is this. When this grade finishes reading this, we move the books to another grade. And the whole concept is that we're creating a community of excellence championed by the chief and the elders and the parents. And in fact, in those communities, what we are doing differently is that for those parents who cannot read, there's going to be literacy classes for them so that they can read with their children. We are selecting 50 communities across the country. And what will happen in that community will convince people that community participation is key. Because the entire community is going to know that by primary four, which is age 10, every child in this community should be helped to read. And if they can't read now, there's a literacy coach. And by the way, there's a library in this village and the children have access to books. And when they don't have access to books, the next village that is incrementing the community of excellence will exchange the books with them. And consequently, what we are trying to do here is that we are trying to put into this community everything that a school needs in order for them to succeed. But it's going to be championed by the chief, and the educators will be in support role. So that the chief is the one who is going to say, are my children in this village reading? The parents are going to come in and celebrate learning. And we've directed that parents whose children have 100% attendance will be recognized. The same way that I did in my school in LA, where we had recognition events and parents were given certificates of recognition for the attendance of their students. Because we realized that if the parents were not involved, the kids were not going to show up in an urban school environment in Los Angeles. And when we were getting 98% average daily attendance, we gave the credit to the parents and we supported them. In Los Angeles, we have what we call a family development institute. Once a month, parents were coming to learn how they can support their children to succeed, understanding that in the Los Angeles environment, the immigrant parent could not teach fixes, support his son in chemistry. It was left to us. But what we needed was the motivation of the parents to get the child to come to school. And once the child is there, then we do extra classes and extra activities for them to succeed. So the part that the uneducated parent cannot bring to the table, then we compensate for that with their motivation through their children so that the children will come and sit there understanding that my mom wants me here, my dad wants me here, they want me to succeed. And in that case, the school is telling the same thing to the child as the parent. But we were preaching to them about the fact that they can succeed. We were preaching to them about the American dream and that everything was possible. And now the parent who is an immigrant is also telling the same story to the child that you can succeed. Right. Your African-American parent is also telling the child that, hey, what I couldn't do, you can. And I was always looking at that and looking at what my father, who was uneducated, did. He was actually the ambassador for education in my village as the chief. He went to every single class to motivate the children and tell them, I want you to become who I didn't become.
That's a great story.
So he didn't go to school, but he was able to motivate. So
and you actually, Minister, I already answered a question I was going to pose. We had three or four questions that came in. You're ahead of the game, as usual. Three or four questions come in about how can you engage parents who are not educated themselves in low resource environments, et cetera. So those are great examples. Sarah, I'd like to shift to you. Tell us about your perspective on family school engagement, why it's important. And do you also have some great examples about what might we do and what might give you hope?
Yeah, thanks so much, Rebecca. And I think the minister's examples are really sharp about the kinds of things that families and schools can do together. You know, your reference of the 100-year gap and the global pandemic, it really does bring about the urgency of the moment. Many years ago, when I worked with these programs of really trying to target girls who are out of school or at risk of dropout, we knew that families were critical to supporting everything from changing workload patterns and boosting self-confidence to ensuring that children have really aspirations for their future. What did they see of themselves? Because we know that exposure and encouragement of exploration of different kinds of content and ways of thinking about the world, it supports that motivation and curiosity to learn that really undercuts children's success in an educational environment. So it's important not only for parents to do that, but for older siblings and community members, just as the minister was talking about. Here at the foundation, we've seen many of those things repeated. Our recent experiences with COVID, for example, our partners have been telling us that parents with the best intentions, they want to support their kids. They really just don't know how. I think the quote that you brought about of a parent sort of reflecting that this is the first time that I really understand what my child is doing. Now that you understand that, how do you take on the teaching task? Reinforcing learning at home, good learning habits. How do you encourage and really give the positive place and ensure that the parents have the tools that they need? And we've certainly seen a lot of focus on that in our work at the foundation. We also know that we need to support teachers when they're working with children in new ways, so that if we value these holistic learning skills, moving from maths and reading to include collaboration and problem solving and creativity, teachers really need parents and families to support this idea that you have to be a little chaotic to allow children to explore those things. And that can be a bit scary because it's less linear and less easy for skills to be quantified and assessed in those environments. And that way, it's a true engagement where families can support teachers to act in that sort of way in order to develop these skills that we think are really important. And I would just say, you know, what I find hopeful about the current moment is that the urgency of trying to make sure that children are staying on task and being able to thrive and grow in the current environment, we know that there's a lot more partnerships that are being strengthened between school to home and home to school. And that strengthened engagement, I'm very hopeful, will not sort of turn back even as things start to open up and hopefully get better with the pandemic.
That's great. I want to go from hope and great strategies to a question that we have from Denise from the Institute of Education on really what are the barriers to good family school engagement? What is it that's keeping us back? And I wanted to say, to frame this in terms of the insights that we've had in our team, is that it seems like schools have de facto, just normal, a kind of inward orientation. And we see that in the fact OECD, for example, did a survey of almost 60 countries during COVID about countries, how they were planning their school reopening plans. And only 25% of countries even consulted parents and their family reopening plans, even in the time of COVID. And so in some ways, schools are caught in the crosshairs. We know this from a lot of the focus groups with teachers also about, you know, language of instruction and who gets access to the good schools and how history is taught in our, in my country, how race is taught is a huge issue at the moment. And I think that might've made schools sort of put their walls up to try to protect themselves. So at the same time, they need to reach out in all the strategies you guys just talked about. So there's a bit of attention there. So I'd love to hear, Minister, from you, what do you think the barriers are? What's stopping good family school engagement in Ghana in particular?
In Ghana, you're going to realize that we have 30% of our students in private primary and junior high school. And 70% in public. The 30% happens to be your middle class, upper middle class. In the primary and junior high school, they will go to private. Then they prepare themselves very well so that they can then come and occupy the top level public high schools. Now, this 30% have engagement with schools. Then the 70% don't. Sometimes they don't even know that they have a role. And the schools have made it as if they take it or leave it. Consequently, the outcomes then does not come out the way it should. And they are less likely to then move on to high school to be part of the top performing school. And if they get there, we have a system here in Ghana where based on your aggregate from the junior high school exam, that is how you get to do science. There's a science pathway, the arts pathway, the visual arts pathway. We've created a system that selects based on your performance on the junior high school exams. And now we have a serious inequity in terms of who get to do science and consequently become engineer or medical doctor, for that matter, move up generally. So in Ghana, in the private school setting, high parent participation. In the public school system, it's limited. And one main reason is that we have not invited them in. We don't see them as part of the solution. And consequently, the culture has been created in such a way that parents don't feel welcome. And I see the same thing in urban America, where in my charter school, we had to make a conscious effort to bring them in. Yesterday, we were doing the National Education Week event, and one of the leaders talked about, where are the parents? Why are they not coming? And I went up and responded and said, have you invited them? And have you motivated them? Have you recognized them when they come? So we as a system now have to design strategies to bring them in. And that is what we are doing now with the Ghana Education Service, so that schools will implement strategies to bring the parents in. And the good news for us is that now we are doing a student information system, setting it up across the country. And what that is going to do is that they will, every school, report parent attendance for their parent meetings on the student information system. So sitting in Accra, we'll be able to know, wow, this school has parents going to meetings. This school, the parents are not going. Then we'll be able to look at how do we invite them in. But I'll tell you, the barrier is cultural. The barrier is that we haven't seen them as part of the solution. And with COVID-19, as you rightly pointed out, the barrier is broken. It's breaking. Now the parents feel like, I need to know where my child is when they go to school because I want to make sure they are safe. So that is an incentive for them to go to the school when you invite them, but they want to say, okay, what is the classroom arrangement? Is my child safe? So COVID has brought a greater sense of urgency,
right,
which then makes it easier when we invite them to even come, because they want to physically see, where is my child sitting? His safety is important to me, and I want to know.
Those are a really good holistic outline of sort of the main barriers and strategies we need to move forward. And I wanted to thank you because I know you have to go back to cabinet now. I want to thank your president who relieved you from the cabinet meeting to come participate with us. And I wish you luck. You have some really exciting parent engagement strategies coming up in Ghana, along with many other exciting work. And we wish you luck. So thank you so much, Minister Adutum. And I'm going to turn to Sarah to answer the question. Thank you, Minister.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Take care. Sarah,
great overviews, I think, from the minister for sure. I think, you know, it just, this idea about inviting parents and families to be part of the solution is really important. And we know there's like a spectrum of things. The way we've set up schools can be really intimidating when there's one right answer, we're imparting knowledge, it comes from textbook, there are knowledge holders and knowledge recipients. That can be particularly intimidating for families who come from less status or power within communities. It's the system that we've grown up to and it's a tension that we have to recognize for teachers. So even if they're interested in positioning children as agents of their own learning, parents have to be brought along and really feel welcomed. We also know that teachers have really difficult jobs. So any of us who have tried to invite more opinions and helpers into a process know that that also generates lots of ideas. And because many parents have had firsthand experience with an education, it's easier to have an opinion about how it is that things should unfold. And sometimes that can be a lot to try to put together. So it's easier to keep families at bay sometimes. And you have to understand that teachers are balancing many different things with the curriculum and incentives that they have to move things. It's just an extremely challenging place to be in. But when you can hit that sweet spot where you can invite families to be a part of the solution in a genuine, thoughtful way, it really can accelerate learning for children. And that's the hard part to find, but it's certainly possible.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Sarah. We appreciate it. Thank you for your thoughts and contributions. We'll see you a little later at the end. I'm going to move us on to the next dialogue now. One of the things I want to pick up on that conversation is all the interesting, good, different strategies that both the minister and Sarah brought up. One of the parts of the playbook is that we have is all about solutions and strategies. And that's sort of going to be the theme of the next dialogue. We looked at 500 different strategies and approaches to family engagement across 60 countries and ended up mapping them in terms of their approaches. And I want to show you a visual. We have what we call a strategy landscape. We think about this as a bit of a map. In the center, you have the four goals that we've identified. The top two are around improving systems, improving attendance and completion, and learning development. Goal three and four are really around transforming systems, transforming how the purpose of education for students and then for society. And any one of these goals, you can have your approach take up. Be located in a different place. That's the green, in the home or the community, in the school or the across the education system. In any one of these goals, you can pull different levers and they go both ways. And the levers really, you see them in blue, go from sort of providing information. It could be parents providing information to teachers or teachers providing information to parents, to building relationships, which we've seen is absolutely essential, almost the bedrock to effective family engagement programs, all the way up to co-designing, really having parents and teachers co-design programs or initiatives or approaches together. And then there also is a range of different ways for families to engage. And you'll notice that one of the family roles is that actually you don't need families engaged at all. And when they're not engaged, that usually means that it's really a strategy where it's on the education personnel. It could be training for teachers or school leaders on implicit bias, or really trying to shift that inward orientation mindset to an outward orientation mindset, work that's the education community needs to do to sort of see the assets and benefits that families and communities bring to the table. So we're hoping this helps people locate where they're focused, your organization is focused on family school engagement. And if you're interested in getting inspired about different strategies in any of this, anywhere in this map, we have an interactive database in the playbook where you can go in and search by goal, you can search by country and student age, level, tech level. Most of these aren't required any special technology, quite a few are low tech, no broadband needed, et cetera. And you'll get a bunch of information on how the strategies were done, what the lessons learned were, follow-up materials. And I'm very pleased now to invite up on the screen people who represent two of the strategies that we've highlighted in the playbook, particularly around co-designing. Deputy Secretary Sandoval and Carolina, please join us on video. Thank you both so much for being here. You both were great examples, and Carolina, you can come on video. We're both great examples in the playbook that of where you've really used sort of co-designing with communities and schools to advance one of the goals in the playbook. And I have to say that that was the area where we found least strategies, was the sort of using the design co-design function or lever, I would say. So I'd love to explore first with you, Carolina, a little bit. You started Red Papas. You were one of the founding members in 2003, I believe, and became president in 2004. It was a network of parents in 34 schools in Colombia, and it is now a national parent network across 22 departments of Colombia. Can you just tell us a little bit about Red Papas?
Thank you, Rebecca. Yes, Red Papas is a civil, Colombian civil society organization founded by a group of parents and educators that wanted to help create a world where children are the priority and the most important actors in all decisions. We established a parent network through a school. Now we are 523 schools, almost 750,000 parents in many regions of our country. Our pillars are family engagement, family school partnership, children's rights, and development in a healthy and caring environment. We are more than 40 employees in Bogota, but also in the regions when we work with volunteers, schools, and families.
Wonderful. And I know that you have a really interesting model I've been mentioning this model to people who have inquired after learning about it from you. And you're sharing it with other members of the Family Engagement Network, I know, where you have Red Papas liaisons at schools who are sort of seeing how, what are the issues? What's going on in your schools? And then they, whatever the issues are, you have this sort of systematic way of lifting up topics to regional representatives, and then you take them sort of nationally. So it's a very bottom-up approach with your basically 750,000 parents you have in your network. Do you want to share with us any sort of other unique features or reasons you think this is so effective, this model?
I think because we really like hear them and we try to provide tools and resources to parents and also to schools in educational and social emotional issues. But these issues is that why they care about what the parents are worried about. At the same time, we empower communities to advocate for children's rights in order to close the enormous gaps of inequity that we have. We also establish 4 programs in Colombia, Aprendiendo a Ser Papás, for parents and school resources. Entre Todos is a petition site. Te Protejo is a hotline to receive reports related with people under 18 as violent, child sexual abuse materials. And the new one is Vigías, our safer internet center. We also build partnerships with many experts and universities that support our work with evidence. With this evidence, we provide technical support to the decision makers. We also translate their knowledge and raise awareness with families and schools.
Great. And actually, one, I was hoping you could give an example, perhaps the example that we've showcased in the playbook of how that's worked from sort of start to finish. Perhaps the example of inclusive education, where it really started as a deep concern in schools and ended with you co-designing national legislation with the ministry.
Okay, since 2010, we were working with other organizations in Colombia in order to include children with disabilities in regular education. We established La Alianza por la Inclusión, and we are developing a tool called Kid Papas Inclusión in order to help families and school communities to embrace and respect the diversity. In July 2012, a town, one of our partners asked us to help them in order to urge the government to be inclusive, because the campaign launched by them called De Cero a Siempre, From Zero to Always, focused on early education, didn't include children with disabilities. We launched together an online petition called Invisibles No Más, Invisible No More, and in just 2 months, the government accepted the mistake and included a child with physical disability in the main image in the video of the campaign, but also this kind of diversity in the government strategy.
Wonderful. Thank you, Carolina. It's a great sort of testament to the power of parent and family, family and school collaboration. Deputy Secretary Sandoval, I'd like to turn to you now. You have for a long time been an advocate of the community school approach. And whereas I think Carolina's story really illustrates the power of family school collaboration for improving systems, improving attendance, improving completion, making sure there's inclusive education, I think your story and this idea of a community schools approach really illustrates the idea of transforming systems, transforming how you think about the purpose of education, both for students and for society. And I'd like to take you back, if you wouldn't mind, to 1999, when you co-founded or founded solely or co-founded, I can't remember, South Valley Academy in New Mexico and Albuquerque. And I know that you, your experience of really hearing from families and communities transformed how you thought about that school and how you've thought about schooling ever since. Could you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Absolutely, Rebecca. Yeah, it's taken me back quite a ways and to some original home visits and home meetings where my co-founder and I were really intent on creating a charter school in the neighborhood I grew up in that would transform outcomes, not just for students who attended, but for their families. New Mexico is one of the poorest, economically poorest states in the United States. It's on the border, as you know. And so in my neighborhood, many of us are children and grandchildren of immigrants. Like we know, and the minister was saying, many immigrants coming for that search for a better life, to escape the dire consequences many times of extreme poverty. And so we knew that we couldn't transform the system without being cognizant of the effects of poverty. And that really does require system level transformation and involves the community. So at those home visits, we really heard and asked parents, what are your hopes and aspirations? We're creating this brand new school, secondary school, high school. And one message that was loud and clear was, we want our students to be academically successful, but we don't want them to forget who they are. And that was really the basis for one of our core values, which is, as we know in the United States, the education system has been very intent, especially in New Mexico as well, of measuring the core academics, reading and math. The entire system was designed around reading and math scores and giving designations to schools depending on how well they did, which is appropriate. Let me first say that that's completely appropriate. But if we really want to attend to the impacts of poverty and leapfrogging, I love that idea, leapfrogging inequity, you have to do more than that. And you have to involve the community and the family to be part of the transformation. And so we, together with our families, have this mantra that we're raising children first and test scores second, right? There, it's a yes and, but you got to raise children first. And what that means is schools need an entire department who pay attention to these relationships and they institutionalize it. So at South Valley Academy, we did just that. We did two things. One is we created an advisory program, which many schools across the world and in the US have now, where each child has an advisor and it's their point of contact with the family and the child so that, and it's small, it's usually about 10 students. So you build those intentional relationships through text messages, through quarterly conferences. We found that that kind of personal relationship was much more effective with families, especially those who are working two or three jobs. They're not available to come to, for example, a parent-teacher association meeting in the evening because they're at work. But if they're getting text messages or a phone call on the weekend, they will respond to that kind of outreach, was our experience. In addition to the advisory program, we also built out an entire department, just like there's a math department, a science department. It's called service learning. And so we hired teachers who were professionals and experts in developing relationships and being outwardly facing with the community. And the entire curriculum of service learning is built around community and the strengths that already exist there. So these teachers would purposely build the curriculum and experiences for our students, where our students, often in ninth grade, would go back to their elementary schools and be literacy tutors and would read to their neighbors and their cousins and their little brothers and sisters and be role models. And we saw some of our students who just shine in that regard and really develop their skills. And then sophomore year was a focus on community-based organizations and understanding what a food bank was. And really, again, being transformative so that they saw themselves as agents in their own community to fight against the impacts of poverty. And so, and that ultimately led to the school and our governing council being really intentional about other opportunities to develop our parents. And so we found that many of our parents who were immigrants said, we would love classes in the evening around how to use a computer, how to apply through the internet, English language acquisition. So we started developing all of those courses for our families in the evening. And then they were looking for work, right? And so I said, well, we have a food service program. We need people to cook breakfast and lunch and dinner. We created the process in such a way where our parents were able to be the ones to apply for those. And so guess what? Now they're working in the cafeteria, cooking food for their own children. And our students swear that this is the best food ever. Many of our parents provide janitorial services in the office. I mean, again, it's our own community working at the school to serve our children.
I think you just answered, there's two questions that have come in. I think you just answered beautifully, Deputy Secretary, a question from Ross from the Jacobs Foundation about how can engaging with families create sort of a community-wide learning ecosystems where kids are learning not just in school, but across the platform. And we've also had a question from Pritika from the Akanksha Foundation talking about how can we expect families who are really, you know, struggling to put food on the table to engage with school. But if you employ them in the cafeteria, or if you make, you know, sort of literacy classes that they need for their future betterment in the school, then obviously they're going to be engaged. So thank you for that. Did you want to add one thing there?
I was just going to add the community school model, which many states in the US, including New Mexico, is promoting, is providing just that. There's additional funding for schools to hire a full-time coordinator. And this person's job is to coordinate, map out the assets. It's called asset mapping. They develop those intentional relationships. They make sure that the school has a council where parents and community members are part of that council to help drive the instructional vision as well as the way the school is open and welcoming. So we understand that schools now need that. They need departments, they need personnel to do this work.
And can you just in a brief sort of 1-2 minutes, tell us a little bit about now, fast forward 20 plus years from the founding of the school and that formative experience. And I know you were a teacher for many years and have had a long and distinguished education career. You're sitting running in charge of academic achievement and finance and many pieces of running the public education department in New Mexico. And I know you're looking at scaling this community schools approach. Can you just tell us some insights or lessons learned about how you take it from, you know, one school to an entire system, this community schools model?
Absolutely. So we as a state have been very fortunate to have community schools and have had them for quite some time before bringing it to scale. So we had enough critical mass, especially in the metropolitan areas of our state, where the county was involved, the city government was involved, and they had a model to say, we have something that we'd love to share across our state and bring to scale. So our state legislature has invested millions of dollars into this model. Our teacher unions very much support it because, again, they understand that teachers need support. Schools need people and personnel to do this work and how critical and transformative it can be. So we've been very fortunate to have had this investment. We now are going into year 4, and it's actually a 4-year grant program. So schools who are interested in the model can apply for a planning grant. They get $50,000 and just to plan it out and do the asset mapping and think with their community, what does that mean for us? And then they submit another grant at the end of the planning grant, which is $150,000 to pay for the personnel to implement the model for 3 years. And then we are now coming upon our very first cohort. They're ending their 3rd year. And we are now working with our legislature to propose sustainability funding so that even if you go through the 4-year grant process, there's a mechanism by which you can continue to pay these additional folks at your school to do this work. So very excited about that.
It's a very, very cool thing you're doing, and we are watching closely. I want to actually thank you both for your thoughts and contributions. I'm going to move us on to the next sort of final conclusion, and we will invite you back on the screen in a little bit. So thank you, Carolina, and thank you, Deputy Secretary Sandoval. So one of the questions we received was from Brendan from CITRS. And he asked, you know, what is the one thing that schools should really think about and do if they're to advance family school engagement? And my answer and reflection from all the work on the playbook is really to build relational trust. And I'll show you some visuals from the playbook. One of the deep insights that we've had is that it's incredibly important to make the space and time to have an intentional conversation around what a good quality education looks like with your families, with your teachers, with your school leaders, with your students, with your employers, et cetera. And part of why this is so important is it is a really good way to begin building relational trust. One of the things we do note is that not any family engagement, school family collaboration or engagement is very effective. The ones that are highly effective are those that have existing relational trust. And we also know that those that are highly cost effective are where schools are sharing information from trusted messengers. And in our surveys of parents, and we should say we survey primary caregivers, we use parents and family members and primary caregivers interchangeably. In our survey of parents and teachers, we found that actually their beliefs are kind of different around what the purpose of education is, what a good quality teaching and learning experience looks like, what makes for a good quality school. Here you'll see one little piece of our data and analysis. On the left-hand side are the teachers, on the right-hand side are the parents. This is a visualization of a question which we asked, what was the most important purpose of school? And the blue is really around parents and teachers who answered a socio-emotional development of children, sort of finding their personal sense of purpose, et cetera, and individual development is really the most important purpose of school. That's heavily where teachers landed and quite a bit also where parents landed. The orange is academic purpose of school. So preparation, rigorous content preparation for post-secondary. A lot more parents are interested in academic prep than teachers. Interestingly, the gray is the economic purpose, sort of schools developing skills for work. And the yellow is the civic purpose, which is schools developing citizenship skills. Now, schools do all of these things, but this really shows you where is the lean, where is the pull, where is the focus of parents and teachers. And you'll note that actually teachers are much more homogenous in terms of their vision. And parents are quite diverse, although they do really privilege, actually, it's a little hard to see here, but most of them privilege socio-emotional. But what was very striking was when we asked parents their perception of what they thought the colored lines looked like for teachers. We said, you know, what do you think teachers answered to this question of what is the most important purpose of school? And they came back saying, it's all orange. Teachers only care about academics. So we know from the system transformation literature that when you have sort of beliefs that are not aligned, and even more when you have perceptions of each other's beliefs that are even farther apart, it is a really good lever for change to bring people together and have a deep conversation about what is the purpose, what does good quality look like, and get on the same page and same vision. And that's why in the playbook we have put forward based, this evidence was based on serving 25,000 teachers and 6,000 parents across 10 countries. And from that inspiration, we've put forward a series of tools, conversation starter tools. They're very much prototypes. They are to help guide you to have an intentional conversation with the different stakeholders in your community about what you want for your children and what a good quality education looks like. We invite you to use them, try them. If you are doing it and adapting it and seeing how it goes, we would love to know about it. We are working with a series of partners after starting tomorrow to pilot this conversation starter toolkit. And we would love to wrap you into that process or include you in that process if you're interested. So given that, I wanted to invite back on the screen Sarah and Carolina and Deputy Secretary Sandoval to help finish this conversation and wrap us out. I will ask you in a minute to just give a final quick lightning round closing comment, but I did want to hear your answer to Brendan's question, which is what is the one thing that schools should do? I think it's relational trust, but do you agree? And if not, what else would you put out in front? Carolina, let's start with you.
Thank you, Rebecca. I agree with the importance of building a trust is a key issue for having a strong and long-lasting relationship between families and school in order to work together and advance in the protection of the children. It is very important to always have in mind that children should be in the center of this relation. We propose 7 actions to schools and parents in order to build, strengthen, and maintain the confidence and a good work together. 1 is prioritize the school and families' relation and work. The 2nd is plan actions together. The 3rd, maintain a proactive and a persistent communication in a double way. The 4th, always give positive feedback. 5, personalize the communications. 7, give practical tips to parents. And 7, be monitoring actions and programs.
That's incredibly helpful. not only, yes, that's the most important, but here's the 7 ways to do it. Thank you so much, Carolina. Sarah, I'd like to come to you. What do you think is, do you agree that establishing relational trust is kind of the most important, or do you have something else that you think?
Yeah, no, I'm in agreement. And I think that Carolina's list is fantastic. I just would add to this from our experience with lots of different partners and other donors that it takes time. So much of this is contextual and sort of staying persistent about it and setting up ways to learn and ensure that there's iteration about how you continually get that better with reflection that involves children and families and school administrators and teachers themselves, I think is really important to that.
Okay, great. Do you have anything else to add, Deputy Secretary?
I completely agree and would encourage schools or institutions to find a way to hire at least 1 full-time coordinator to do this work and to build this trust. You will need a person whose energy and time is to make room for that relational trust. And there's lots of ways to do it. There's, at least in the US, there's different funding mechanisms to do that and ways to do that. So absolutely.
Okay, great. All right, we're in agreement. So Brendan, there is your answer. To close out, you guys, all of you have seen the playbook, been part of its work over the months, years, months at least. And I'm wondering if you could just quick lightning round, 30 seconds each in our last minute here, give 1 piece of advice to your peers. So Carolina, what piece of advice would you give to other leaders of parent networks?
The first one, become a positive leader, a leader that understands other parents' situations, especially what happened to the most vulnerable in the community. The 2nd one, allow parents to have a voice. You will be their voice, and then everyone will hear you. The 3rd one, always try to find solutions with others. Parents usually have a lot of worries, but they don't have answers. You will help them to find paths, ways, and solutions. And the 4th one, build a network. Parents have an enormous power because our motive is the love for our children.
Thank you,
Rebecca.
Thank you, Carolina. All right, let's go from parent leaders of parent networks. Deputy Secretary, what would you tell to your other sort of state level policymakers?
I would encourage them to find sustainable funding mechanisms so that school districts and schools can actually hire these coordinators or these entire departments that would be building ongoing trust. And so schools need that. We've got funding for academic teachers. We need funding for folks to do this work.
Okay, great. And last word, Sarah, what would you tell other funders and donors?
Yeah, I would just say, you know, it takes persistence, this kind of work. So give flexibility to your grantees to really think more about how to do this and make sure that you've got in the cycles of iteration. And then share it widely as much as you can and recognize that that's part of your responsibility and role in the ecosystem as a funder.
Wonderful. Well, that's it. Thank you all 3 for taking your time to be with us. And thanks everybody for being with us, and check out the playbook on the brookings.edu website. Take care.